Hi there, and welcome to yet another edition of Comfortably Unnumb, the official podcast of the Umbrella Society. My name is Blake Anderson, the program's manager here at Umbrella, and also the host of this podcast. And as always, I'm coming to you today from beautiful Victoria, British Columbia, on the traditional unceded territories of the Algonquin-speaking peoples. And just like that, we are at episode 10 of season 2. We wrapped up our first season of Comfortably Unnumb after 10 episodes. But this year, we're going to be expanding into the spring as I have plenty more folks to talk to. And at the end of the day, these stories are making an impact, so we're just going to keep them coming for now. So today's guest is a real treat for me, as I've never met this individual before. It's really nice to hear someone's story for the first time and come to it a little bit fresh. We have a lady named Alicia coming onto the program, who was highly recommended for me to ask onto the program. Alicia is a hardworking mother whose son is the light of her life, but Alicia struggles with alcohol, which has been present since her teenage years, and continued to plague her during the early years of her son's life, to the extent that she had to make a hard decision to leave alcohol behind her so that she could be the amazing parent that she always wanted to be. Alicia's story is a clear example of the grip that substances can have over our life and shows the courage necessary to make the big changes in our life. So I'm happy to introduce Alicia to the program. Okay, Alicia, thank you so much for coming on. Yeah, we were kind of talking. This is a bit of a new experience for you, doing a podcast, and it's always interesting once the record button gets pushed on. But I'm really happy that you've taken the time to come on in. You know, you were recommended to come on this podcast from our buddy Trevor, who's working for us, and you know, I really appreciate you having the courage and taking the time to come on.
Thank you. I'm feeling really nervous, so if I stumble my words, it's just, I've never done something like this before, so I'm excited. Yeah. I'm grateful. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. No, and that's great. I love it. This, like I said, this is a nice, authentic experience, and we love that, and we love the vulnerability to be able to say that. So don't worry. Take your time. I think we've got a very forgiving audience base. So yeah, it's great. So I mean, like I was saying, this is a cool experience for me, because this first time we met was today, and so I don't know your story, and I've had a lot of people on where I've had quite an intimate knowledge and experience with somebody and their story, and so it's really cool to bring on somebody new, and I get to hear it for the first time as well. We were talking earlier about addiction and where it kind of showed up in your life, and you said this was kind of a hereditary thing. Hey, you feel like this was something that's been present in your life from the get-go, hey?
From the get-go, yeah. I don't think it came to light, really, until quite a few years after I was born, but definitely something that's a generational thing passed down on both sides of my family, and you know, something that I carry and hope to kind of bring awareness to for my son, so that it kind of stops with me, and I'm able to kind of change the way my life looks today. So yeah, it's definitely something that's been, I've dealt with my whole life. So right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you have experience with, you know, family members growing up and stuff? Did you, a lot of people kind of, that's where they learned,
Yeah.
Through parents and the actions of their parents, or?
I think it was difficult for me with my family because, addiction, alcoholism especially, was not something that was talked about in my family. Right. The very first time I ever talked about it, I was already in treatment, and, and that was, I was in my 30s at that point. So it wasn't something that was ever shared or spoken about in my family growing up. It was always around, and I lost my two of my grandparents to alcoholism, one before I was even born, but still something we just didn't share. And so I had no kind of insight or outlet to talk about what was going on for our family. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it's amazing how far we've come in the last few years, where people are becoming more vocal and okay to talk about, addiction, mental health challenges, but yeah, back in the day, it's just something, especially with, you're right, with alcohol, it's something that was just so socially acceptable.
Yeah.
And we still see that today, but more so, yeah, back when we were growing up, it's was really hard because, yeah, it's just something that, yeah, it doesn't get discussed, right? So hard to process and to kind of, yeah, put anything into practice.
Yeah, I mean, we all had that fun uncle who would always fall asleep at the dinner table, right? But no one ever talked about what was really going on,
right.
So
yeah.
It's it's nice that we're able to bring awareness to what's actually going on and how we can make a difference and change,
right.
you know, yeah. the way our lives are going. So,
right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's great. So, as far as yourself and your own personal journey, you know, when did substances start, you know, showing themselves in your life? Was it an early start for you, or did it, everybody has a different story of, you know, how addiction and substances was introduced?
Yeah. I mean, my first drink was at 11 years old, and I can still remember where it was and what we were doing and how it made me feel. And it wasn't something I had planned. It wasn't something that I kind of thought, this is what I want to do, right? Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, at that age and in your early teens, it's just, you're surrounded by things where you make a choice whether you want to try something or you don't want to try something. And right. and I was given a choice at that age, and it just seemed like the fun thing to do, right? Not knowing, especially because not ever talking about it with my family, how detrimental it could be to my life. Specifically, I thought I was untouchable, right? Because we didn't talk about it. So,
So it's just this fun thing that everyone else is doing. Yeah. And you might as well give it a try.
Might as well, right?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so for you, was it, you know, kind of love at first drink, or did it take a while? Like, I mean, was this something that was a bit of a slow burn for you? What did your early teen years look like? Was it a lot of partying, or was it just
Yeah, I mean, it was love at first drink, absolutely. It I was one of those people who I was good in school. I was on all the sports teams. I was well liked, but I wasn't loved. You know, it was just this idea of, well, I was accepted, but not really embraced. And so when I took that first drink, it felt like there was a void in me that had been filled, right? And so it's almost like it just took on a new approach to how I felt about myself and how I thought people would see me. And so it was absolutely, I was, from probably before my first drink, I was addicted, but that drink changed something in me. So
right. And I think that's the hard part, you know, with substance use in teen years, is there's a sense of identity that almost gets attached to this as well, right? And a sense of belonging. Which is dangerous.
Absolutely. Especially at that age, right? And when you don't know, you know that it's not something you should be doing, so you keep it a secret, right? And then it just manifests into such a bigger thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, obviously, you know, with this is something that, you know, introduced at an early enough age and, you know, there's identity wrapped up into it. Where did it progress for you, you know, throughout high school? Was there a point where you could recognize that there was a problem, or was this just like, you know, what kids did? And, you know, what was your thinking around it at the time?
I mean, I don't think that I recognized that it was a problem for me until I was in my 20s. It was because I was able to maintain the grades that I needed and maintain my sports commitments and maintain my friendships. It was almost like I had everything kind of where they needed to be. And so while I always knew that I drank more than all of my friends, I had always just thought, you know, I'm just, you know, I can handle it better, right? And which is, you know, looking back, not the case, but
Well, I think that's a hard position to be when, you know, and you see that when substances are a challenge, but it isn't a detriment, where, like you say, you're still getting school done, you're still achieving kind of those goals, those life goals, so that you don't have this glaring, you know, issue kind of staring at you at this point, right?
Yeah.
So how did that look? So you're still, you know, fully participating in sports all through high school.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing well at school. And then in, you know, graduating, getting into like early adult life, did it change for you at all?
You know, I think, you know, just to backtrack a little bit, part of what made it easy for me to keep it under the radar was, you know, my relationship with my family was also, I was that child that did everything by the books, and I had a younger sister who was doing everything outside of the books. And while she was experimenting with drugs and alcohol for herself, it was taking over her life, whereas I was able to maintain my life. And so I think that for me, my alcoholism was able to ramp up under the surface because everybody was so focused on what was going on for my other, like for my sister. And so I remember I was 16 years old and I was having a fight with my mom and she was kicking me out of the house because that's when my parents got a divorce and she was sending me to my dad's and she pulled out all the drawers in my bedroom and started throwing my clothes at me to get out. And there was bottles in there and she had no idea that my drinking had been to a place where I was hiding them in my cupboards, right? And so I think that was the first time a family member ever even noticed that I drank. And so
okay, so you're kind of flying under the radar.
Absolutely,
right? Yeah. How much younger is your sister?
She's 4 years younger. Great. So okay, yeah, she addiction, as I said, runs in our family, and so for her it took over completely. And so
right,
yeah, it was tough.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that makes it so much harder to manage when you can fly under the radar. Yeah. Where the focus is off you.
Exactly.
And was it, you know, was that yourself too? Like, hey, I don't have as big a problem. Like, look at my sister kind of thing. Was
kind
that,
of. Yeah. But it was also like, I felt that alcohol wasn't necessarily her downfall. She struggled a lot with harder drugs. And so I always tried to be the responsible sister in that I wouldn't go do that because I wanted to set a good example for her. But right. then I would drink my face off because right. that wasn't her,
right.
her DOC, right? And so that was my addict rationalizing why it was okay to be drinking as much as I was, you know, at 16 years old. So
right. Right.
Yeah.
And kind of back to that socially acceptable piece with drinking, right?
Like, exactly. Oh, I'm at not, 16, right?
I'm not doing hard drugs, but right. Okay.
Exactly.
Huh. And what was your mom's reaction when she found these bottles in your room? Was it?
I think that it was a lot of anger. Well, we were in an argument, and so there was a lot of anger, but I think there was a lot of fear. If I look back now at honestly how she reacted, there was so much going on in our family with a divorce and my sister's addictions and that it was like she just couldn't fathom having to deal with something else. And that's why if I kept it under wraps, it wasn't burdening anybody, my using, right? And so I was able to keep it. Everyone thought Alicia was okay, right?
Right, okay.
So.
Yeah, yeah. So all of a sudden it's kind of there.
Yeah. I wasn't okay, but still managing at 16. Yeah.
Okay. So interesting. So obviously, you know, signs of some real, real problems back then. Did you identify it as a problem back then?
Absolutely not.
No. Okay.
No.
It was just something, right? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, no, because it made me feel good, right? It made me feel accepted.
Yeah.
It made me feel funny. It was all of those things that I had been missing. And a lot of that was just, you know, growing up in a family where we weren't very emotional. I did not... I had emotional needs that weren't met. And so when I was drinking, I would be outgoing and get the attention and like the love that I needed that I wasn't able to get at home. And so,
So it kind of allowed you to kind of let down that guard.
Exactly.
That's funny. I was the manager at Foundation House for a bunch of years. And that's a huge thing is trying to actually have those emotional connections in sobriety. And it's funny how many people, or it blows your mind how many people, you know, didn't have that growing up, or it wasn't, you know, it really wasn't something that was evident in someone's life. And I think, yeah, you're totally right. So I think the substances does kind of play a part in that. It does fill that void in a sense, right?
Yeah. I think that when our emotional needs aren't met as children, that's when our addictions kind of manifest, right? Because they're filling voids in our lives. And so for me, when I do reflection on my life now, it's like I look back at where my eating disorder started, and it started as a child as young as 4 or 5, right? Because I was filling an emotional void. And so I filled that with food as a place, as a way to find love within myself. And then a few years later, introducing alcohol into my life, it just manifested into this whole filling of myself with things that became unhealthy, right?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Which felt good.
Oh, at the time. Yeah. It made me feel whole, right? And you go through your life not feeling whole, like you're not good enough, right? And then all of a sudden you introduce these substances and you feel like yourself, but it's not who you are.
Right. Yeah. Right. And you know, it's funny. I always like that, you know, idea that we do have to, you know, accept at least, you know, the fact that the substances or, you know, addiction gave us something, mm-hmm. and identifying what that is, right? Yeah. And it is filling a void. So, that's interesting. And, you know, obviously getting through high school and you're, mm-hmm. you're feeling like you're, you know, don't have a problem. You're now kind of getting into your early adulthood. Was there a changing of gears with your substance use? Did it ramp up, or was it like just always kind of kept at a manageable state for you?
You know, it always kind of kept, I mean, manageable. I don't know. I should say manageable now, but I was able to. I mean, I maintained high school. I went to college. I worked, and yeah, it just all seemed. But I knew that I was excess, you know. Okay. Like I remember I had a girlfriend, because I was working full-time and going to school, I had a girlfriend who couldn't afford to go out as often as I could, and I would just pay, right? And at one point she owed me $1,500. Okay. And in our early 20s, right, because I just needed somebody to come with me, right, all the time, the right? Right, yeah, if right. She's listening, she probably knows who I'm talking about, but right. Right. Yeah, it was, I just knew that I wanted to do it all the time. And in your early 20s, it felt okay. Like nobody was telling me that I had a problem. And I thought, if nobody's telling me, then it should be fine, right? I'm still able to do this, that, and the other thing, right?
You're still getting up and going to school, going to work.
I mean, when I look back, it's probably I wasn't at my best, but I was still there. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're still functioning in a certain sense. Yeah.
But I was also paying for my own way in college. And then I started skipping classes because I was hungover or I wanted to go out and do something. And then I just kind of calculated how much I was wasting by not going to college. And so that college went to the wayside. Right. And I think that was one of the first big things in my life that I missed out on because of my drinking. Right. If I look back, that was
the catalyst for kind of,
that was a big decision. And, and you know, like I still think about now that I wish I could go back to school which I can.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was definitely, I think, one of the first big life things that I stopped.
Or you were sacrificing for exactly. your lifestyle. Yeah. Interesting. And you know, as far as frequency, were you kind of like a, go hard on the weekends, or was it becoming like was it a daily thing, or was it
it wasn't daily at that point, right. No, it was but it was probably 3 or 4 nights a week,
right?
So and I would have the regular spots you would go to, right? If you was growing up on the mainland, you could go to Vancouver whenever you wanted, and
the access
and whatnot for, it was, I definitely frequented them regular bars and whatnot enough times to become a regular, which I thought was wonderful at the time.
Well, and there's that sense of like community and belonging as well, right? Mm-hmm. With that, you know, so that's okay. And so you know obviously that I think that was sounds like a pivotal moment when you stopped college and kind of looking back at the time, it wasn't because you stopped because you wanted to keep drinking, right? But that was just kind of
I was wasting my money, right? I was working at the time, and I was working for my dad, and you know, growing up, my dad had been super involved in my life, and he had kind of been my number one rock, and in my late teens, some things happened in our life, and it ended up being a relationship that I lost, and so I think that also kind of set the tone for where my life was going to go in terms of my relationships with men. And so I think that abandonment by somebody who I cared about so much also was just like this idea where I tried to be perfect my whole life and people still leave, right? And that hurt a lot. And so it was like, well, you know, who else is going to leave next? Like, and when I drank, I lost that fear, right? And so it wasn't, I wasn't fearful that people were going to walk out of my life anymore. And so that, I think, also enhanced the drinking because those feelings were getting stronger.
Right.
Yeah. And it was harder to fill that void, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's the hard part, too, with, you know, with alcohol and substances, mm-hmm. is you know, if you're starting to use that as that coping mechanism, then when the substances aren't there, it's like, you know, the anxiety, it's unbearable,
hard.
Right?
Yeah. And when you're not talking about it, like I didn't share with anybody the actual amount of alcohol I was consuming. And so it wasn't like I could go to my doctor and be honest and get the proper prescriptions for what I needed. And so it was just like, just keep drinking.
Right.
And life will get easier. Right.
Right.
Which is what...
So going down that rabbit hole, essentially, right? Yeah, yeah, that's a harder and harder to climb yourself out of.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
So, you know, what kind of took you? So you're, you know, we're talking early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
When did you get to the point? Was there a moment that you did kind of have that realization or the, you know, at least internally or talking to somebody? When was that point when you realized that you did have a problem? Like was it just still brushed under for a long time?
You know, I think that like when I was 21, I met my son's father, and we got together shortly after. And so it was the first time I had really had a boyfriend and the first time I had really kind of invested long-term time with somebody. And so I think he was probably the first person to really notice that, well, this is a little bit more than normal. But we were also, you know, for me, I kept a company of people who were similar to me, right? You don't necessarily choose to be around non-drinkers when you want to drink all the time. And so for me, it was, I surrounded myself with people who wanted to do similar things, and if they were taking a break that night, I would find somebody else. And so it still wasn't something somebody addressed directly to me.
Everyone was kind of in it as well.
Yeah,
they were battling
exactly.
their own stuff and probably didn't want to deal with
or
that.
They only saw me once a week, right?
Sure,
so they were like, whoa,
yeah.
She was wild that night, but
right.
Yeah.
They didn't see the
that it was every single night.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes a big difference.
But yeah.
So, I mean, with you know, your partner at the time, did he bring this up to you? Was it like just more generally in passing? Was, you know, was that the first time you heard it from somebody?
Oh, you know, it would have been from him and my mom, but that still wasn't for quite a number of years. And I think that, I don't know, because I clearly had a problem, and I don't know why it wasn't talked about before. It wasn't actually until I had my son that we really kind of started talking about how bad it was. And so that was still quite a few, like I was in my 30s when I had my son. So there were still quite a few years where it just kind of went, nobody talked about it, but it was there.
Would you feel it was like a progressive thing for you or?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think one of the biggest catalysts of where I really went on the trajectory to my rock bottom was when we moved to Victoria.
Okay.
We moved in 2015 and we moved away from family, from friends, from our social scene. We came to a place where we didn't know anybody. And there was a lot of hard things that happened to us. When we moved here, my son's dad had a lot of back issues, and so he was spending a lot of time at home, and I was working in an office that I didn't know anybody, and so we were just spinning, and we were so isolated, him and I, that there was nowhere for us to go, and it just became, I would work, and I would come home, and I would drink, and, you know, we were just not happy, and we were also trying to have a child, and so that if anyone else has struggled with getting pregnant and infertility, they can understand that pressure and the pain that comes with not being able to. It just, alcohol was the only thing that numbed that for me.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So.
So I guess. And what was the decision to move to Victoria? If you don't mind me asking.
Well. The housing prices in North Vancouver were outrageous,
so
we wanted to own more than a postage stamp.
Gotcha.
And we wanted to raise a family, and we thought that, you know, being here on the island and closer to some of his family, and I had family up island, and we thought that it was just the right move for us. And, right. and we both had jobs that were interchangeable no matter what city we were in. And
right.
yeah, it just
it seemed to make sense.
It
at
did.
The time.
Right. You know, and, yeah. and I'm grateful that we did make the move, but right. I can see that that definitely, it isolated me and it isolated us to a point where, you know, alcohol was what I felt the only option
right.
to numb the pain that was going on for me in my life.
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess, too, you've taken away that social component of drinking. So mm-hmm. you weren't just surrounding yourself, going out with friends and socializing. Yeah. All of a sudden it's like, oh, no, the friends aren't there, but the
drinking,
alcohol is,
yeah,
is still there. That must have changed things, or at least your viewpoint on.
It changed entirely, because then my drinking became secretive. Right. It wasn't necessarily super secret before,
right.
but when it was just my partner and I, it absolutely was something that I had to really start hiding. And so when that became a secret in our relationship, that mm-hmm. also just kind of made things way worse for us and right. for my alcoholism.
Absolutely. And I would say too, like, that's that. You know, like, fuel to the fire is
exactly.
that secrecy. I always feel like if you could personify addiction, it really, that's where it wants you, right?
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Wants
yeah.
Wants it just between you.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
They say secrets keep you sick, right?
That's right. Yeah.
yeah. And I was, right. I was really sick.
Right.
So.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, 2015. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you said you're kind of moving towards a rock bottom. Obviously, it's a lot more evident and looking like this is mm-hmm. now becoming the major coping mechanism in your life, which
yeah.
is unsustainable and making things harder and harder.
Yeah.
And then you said it was the birth of your son or your son, you know, or.
Yeah. I mean, I remember I used to always say to people that I'll stop drinking when I have a child, you know? So like mm-hmm. I never would have quit for myself. Like, I didn't right. love myself enough to say that I deserve better, right?
Right.
But I always joked and said that when I have a child, I would stop. And it didn't seem like that was a weird thing to say, but when I look back now, I feel sorry for that girl, because I did deserve a
right.
better life than
yeah.
just drinking to oblivion every day to numb pain that I could move through
right.
in a healthy way. So,
right. yeah.
yeah, it was... We ended up having to go through fertility, and we had two miscarriages, so two losses, and then we were blessed with my son. He was born in 2017,
okay.
and, you know, so I stopped drinking when I was pregnant. That was the only time that I did stop drinking.
Right.
But then when he was born, I wasn't able to breastfeed, and I said, oh, that's God telling me that I can drink again, right? And so I just,
okay.
I went right back into drinking, because I truly didn't feel that I was harming my child. And that's
right.
how delusional I was in my addiction, that, you know, I could be absolutely annihilated and still be a good mom. And that's just not the case, right?
Right.
So, yeah, when he was born, I thought that I would have stopped for him. And, you know, even that... I was too far. I was too deep in my addiction that I didn't know how to get out, you know?
Okay.
So at that point I knew I had a problem.
Right.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
was this pretty much, you know, fair, like right after he was born, pretty much?
Right or? After he was born.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was, yeah.
And right back to where you were, like, was it like reduced or, you know, or did
no.
you just kind of just pick up right where you left off essentially?
It was worse because now I was a stay-at-home mom. And
okay.
so being a I didn't have to leave the house and go to work. For eight
right.
hours, right?
right?
I was at home by myself with a newborn, and
there's downtime.
There's a lot of downtime, and so that definitely, like, being at home, made it really, really difficult.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm sure too, the guilt as well. You know.
Well, that's why I would just
top,
keep
right?
drinking,
yeah.
right? You don't want to thaw out and feel a feeling, so you just continue. On with
right.
with the drinking.
Okay.
Yeah. So at that point it was daily, and it was becoming an all day, every day. And it's a slow progression to that. Like, I never thought that I would be a daily drinker,
mm-hmm.
but the moment I wasn't working or like working outside of the home, that's what it was. Right.
right.
And
the structure is kind of gone.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Less,
and
yeah.
It's just it's a slippery slope. And as I got deeper in my addiction, it didn't seem so bad then I was like, okay, well, you know, I'm not doing this at 8 o'clock in the morning, right? Or I'm not doing this. And then you start doing that, right? Because then you're like, well, I'm not doing this. And so it just, it just gets worse and worse.
The justification, I'm fascinated by justification, you know, and how, you know, we can be super, you know, intelligent and rational in some respects and then be able to sell ourselves quite the line and find any angle we can to justify actions. It's really something.
The insanity of it is mind-blowing. When I look back, and I used to say to myself that, you know, I needed to be drunk to make my newborn laugh. Like, wow, to make a newborn laugh. Huh. I needed to be inebriated. And when I look back now, I'm like, that's absolutely insane, right? Because no.
Right. You're going to make your newborn laugh being you.
Or not. You don't need to drink, right? Yeah. So, but that's just where alcohol took me as a parent. And it was not good, right? And unsafe too, you know? And I think that's where it became a topic of discussion was when I do remember my mom and my son's dad having a conversation when they thought I had gone to bed prior to my son being born about Alicia has a problem, right? But they didn't know at that point what to do about it, right? But
And is this something that you overheard?
I did, and I was so angry. Really? And I said, it's none of your business when it's absolutely their business, when it's somebody that they love, right? Yeah. And I didn't know a life without it. And so I was afraid. Scary. Yeah. And when you don't know, at this point, I had been drinking for 20 plus years, right? I'm in my 30s and I don't know any other way. And it's the only thing that's keeping me what I thought was happy, you know, here in Victoria and in a relationship, right? It just was the only thing that I could do.
Only thing you're kind of holding on to.
Yeah.
It was just so integrated into your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was my life.
It went right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how long did this go on for with
my son?
With your son?
So he was born in 2017, and it was definitely getting worse. And in 2019, we ended up getting pregnant again, and I suffered a miscarriage at 18 weeks, which was probably the worst thing I've ever experienced in my life, and I think for my son's dad too. It's just it was something that changed me forever, and I think in that moment it was when I just let go of caring. Yeah, because I remember, you know, my alcoholism was so bad at that point that it happened, and it happened at home. And my son's dad came home, and the first thing I did was go to the liquor store. It had happened less than, like, just hours prior. And the only thing that I could do to cope was go to the liquor store.
Right.
Like, and it breaks my heart, but yeah, that's all I knew.
That was your coping mechanism. Yeah.
Yeah. And probably the biggest, the most painful thing I've ever dealt with. And it was too big to imagine doing without being drunk.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So that happened. And I think that was where I just stopped.
Okay.
Stopped fighting it. I just said, this is it. Right. Which is really hard because I still had a beautiful boy. Right. Who needed me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was 2019. And it was 2020. I remember then the conversations about my drinking were almost daily with my son's dad. You know, it was to a point where it was like, our son isn't safe. Right. You know, you're at home with him. You need to be like, you're just unable to care for him the way he deserves to be cared for. And I was, at this point, I was trying to quit on my own.
Right.
I was trying to just cut it out of my life. I didn't know how, because that was.
But that's almost the start, right? Is those early interventions, almost having to exhaust those options. Like, hey, I can't do this. I don't need.
I had to be.
That surrender isn't there yet, but you're like, But you're trying.
But
that's the start.
Yeah. And I had recognized that was, it, it was harming my son, and I knew I needed to stop. I just didn't know how.
Right.
Yeah. So I tried. I did 7 weeks on my own, just white knuckling it, and okay. It was horrible. Like I do.
Were you doing any meetings or anything like
no.
that?
No.
Oh wow,
like,
you were
so,
just
no,
just
I,
trying to stop
because I had right. no idea. Right.
You
I had
know
this.
The resort. Yeah. Mm-mm. You know what was out there. Yeah.
I had no idea because at this point I still hadn't spoken to anybody except my son's dad and my mom about this idea that I might, maybe, perhaps have a problem.
Right. Okay.
Right. And so.
So that's going to be a lonely and a scary place to try to do that on your own, man. Like, yeah, yeah. And still you getting 7 weeks is pretty, you know, pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So you're doing that completely.
Oh my God. Well, I drank a lot of O'Doul's.
Okay.
Like a lot of
okay.
those near
sure.
beers, right?
Yeah.
A lot of
so,
those.
So but. You had your strategy and you were going to
yeah.
It
was not
into
sustainable.
It. Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I also, you know, I feel for my son's dad because he was just trying desperately to do anything to get me well again, right? And at that right. point, I didn't have any credit card or debit cards or anything like that. So I was not even able to purchase the alcohol. And so that was part of how I wasn't drinking, right?
Right.
And
okay.
and that was just desperation, right?
Right.
To do anything to keep me from drinking. And
bubble wrap, you essentially.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Right. If that was a thing, I probably right. would have been.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I remember we went on a family trip and it was really nice. You know, it was like this. Mm. I had an idea of what sobriety could look like, but then trying to do it on my own with no supports and no kind of community, it was lonely and isolating. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of shame, right? It was like this yeah. idea that, you know, I was putting my son's life in danger, and mm-hmm. and I still didn't know enough about addiction to recognize that it wasn't a choice.
Right.
Like I was genetically dispositioned mm-hmm. for alcoholism, right. right? And then being introduced to it at such a young age and then having it throughout my whole life, right?
Right.
Gaining momentum as like my only coping mechanism, it was just I didn't stand a chance,
right?
And to yeah. not have any support, like I could not have stayed sober,
right?
No matter how much I love my son, right?
Yep.
And
yeah.
and I thought that would be enough, and
yeah.
that alone, I don't think it's enough for anybody to
right.
to beat addiction.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Especially a long-standing addiction.
Oh my gosh,
right?
yeah.
yeah,
and one that is socially. Addiction not, but alcohol is so socially acceptable and it's everywhere, right?
right? Yeah.
That it's, if you don't drink, you're not normal,
right?
Right? Or that's how
or
I felt.
No,
yeah.
I, yeah. if you say, oh, no, no thanks. Why not?
Yeah.
Right?
Are you pregnant?
Yeah, yeah. And the fact that it's just everywhere and
yeah.
in your face all the time.
Yeah,
and, yeah.
exactly. So.
Right? Yeah. So you got through 7 weeks and it just didn't stick for you.
No, and then I was given my cards back, and the very next day I went to the liquor store. It was just like
okay.
my addiction was so deep rooted inside me that even though I knew that I felt better and I was doing right for my family, the very next day it's like my addiction drove me to the liquor store.
Right.
And I remember my son's dad came home from work that day, and he saw me just absolutely not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he packed up a bag for him and for my son, and they left. And that was probably some of the hardest days, like the next coming
yeah.
days. They went to my ex-father-in-law's house, which was in a gated community, so I couldn't
okay.
even get to my
wow.
son if I wanted to. And so I remember spending 4 nights on my son's bedroom floor in his little nursery, just absolutely, completely, so probably more drunk than I've been in my life, because
mm-hmm.
I just could not fathom that I had lost him,
right?
And I couldn't get to him, and I just didn't know how my life had gotten to that place. Like, I am meant to be a mom. Being
mm.
a mom is my biggest joy.
Right.
And I felt like I had just failed completely because, you know, I felt I had chosen alcohol
right.
over my child. And Now I know that's not the case.
Right.
But in those moments, it was just the shame and the pain, you know, of losing all those children, but then also, you know, losing my earth child, right? And so those 4 days were probably some of the hardest moments I've ever felt. And when I think about my life now, I always remember how I felt in that moment, because that moment will make sure I never pick up again,
right?
Because I still hold that pain. And I don't think about it all the time, but I think about it enough to keep me going in my recovery. So.
Not in an unhealthy way.
I don't beat myself over the back over this anymore, but I still get teary about it because it was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I've never felt so alone. Right.
Right. So, you know, four days, obviously, probably that sounds like rock bottom. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was where change started.
Okay.
So I got a call from my son's dad. We were still together at the time. And he said, I'm picking you up and we're going to a counseling session. And I said, do I get our son back? Are you guys coming home? And he said, if you agree to come to this, then yes. So of course, like at that point, I'm like, I will say anything, right?
Yes.
Doing
right.
Okay. is different, right? Because I'm drunk still at this point. And so we went, we ended up at Pegasus, and that was on a Friday. And the woman there said, yeah, you can't stop. You cannot stop on your own. And I said, I know, but I don't know what to do. Right. And she said, you can go to treatment. And I had not even thought about that as an option for me. I just didn't think that I fit that mold. You know, we all have this idea of what a treatment center looks like or what even an alcoholic looks like, right? And I didn't think that was me. And my son's dad said, if you don't go, we're not coming home. And so I said, okay, I'll go to treatment. And I was in Cedars on Monday morning, you know, so I didn't even really have any time to work out a way not to go. It was like, because that's what my addiction would want me to do is say whatever you're going to say and then find a way out
of
it.
It was quick. Yeah.
So quick.
And Cedars is a treatment center on Vancouver Island for those who don't know. And
So
they were able to get you in.
Yeah.
Quick, so you couldn't have time. And I mean, this is the problem we see with a lot of folks is, you know, where you say, okay, I'm going to do it. And then it's like, okay, we just hold the phone for like 3 months.
Yeah.
You know, so obviously, you know, that gives you a lot of time to, you know, second guess that decision. But for in your case, you were lucky in the sense that you were up there before you could kind of think twice. Okay.
I was blessed in that sense. And my family had obviously been talking behind the scenes about how bad it really was. And so we were able to support that because I needed to be completely removed from everything.
Right.
And so I was there on Monday and, you know, I remember thinking, who am I? You know, and what are all my friends back home going to think about me? Mm-hmm. Right. I was so worried about what people were going to think that it's like, I couldn't even register that, you know, I am such an alcoholic that I need to go away.
Mm-hmm.
I remember saying goodbye to my son. He was not even 3 years old, right? So he had no idea. Right. And it was during COVID, and so we weren't allowed visitors. And so my time in treatment, I spent 54 days away from my son. And being the mom that I love being, it was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That is such a long time.
Yeah.
And I had not been away from him. Like those 4 nights were the only nights that I had spent away from him prior to that.
Right.
So it was a total shock to the system.
Yeah, no doubt. And I mean, I think that's such a challenge, you know, that we face this all the time. Parents going to treatment and how it's like, I can't be away from my kids and my family, but with the understanding you're trying to, you know,
to be
know
present.
That understanding to go, hey, this is for the long-term
for
investment
the rest of their lives.
Right? Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, he was so little that he didn't understand.
Right.
But treatment was It was the first time I went to a meeting, because I went to a meeting the very first night I got there, and it was in a room. There was like 75 patients, right? There can be quite a few people at Cedars, and I was like, "Who am I?" You know, because I never thought that my life would get to this place, but here I am.
Right.
You know, and now what do I do with this?
Right.
You know, because I had been good at school my whole life and done as I was told. I was like, okay, I'm just going to do everything. Yeah, I'm going to do everything they tell me to do.
Yeah.
So I don't stay here for the rest of my life. Like, because this is just what it felt like. It felt so final that this was who I am. And yeah, it was really difficult. I mean, when I look back, I'm like, oh my gosh, I had very few chores. I didn't have to cook.
Right.
Like, it was it was an incredible break, but it was also so painful because they really broke me open to what the root of my problem was.
Right. And it's hard work.
Yeah.
It's hard emotional
labor. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Because it's not the substance itself. That is a byproduct of what the actual problems are. And the problems for me stemmed from my family of origin, from my genetics, you know, from how I was raised to what was going on in my family. It's just like all of those things were the real problems. And so when you take away alcohol and you're in treatment, everything is raw and you haven't felt anything for so many years that it's like, I am going to burst.
Right. And you're actually having to face it and talk about it.
Oh my gosh. Right?
Yeah. Without. Yeah. So it's just all at once.
It was very, very difficult.
Right. So, I mean, 54 days and you experience for the most part, you got the most out of it that you could, it sounds like.
I feel like I did. I made some really good connections there. It was hard because my son didn't understand FaceTime, right? He's so little that it was like I didn't get any quality time with him, so I missed him entirely. But I was able to apply myself for the things that needed to get done, and that was actually, you know, I went into treatment for alcoholism, but while there, the center had gotten a concerned person's letter about me, just identifying that I might have an eating disorder. And so it was the very first time anyone had ever talked about it. And I tried to deny it, but you can't deny it with professionals, right? They know.
They could see,
right? Yeah. And so while I was in treatment, you know, I was in there for alcoholism, but I was also in there for eating disorders and also for sex and love, right? Because they all kind of go hand in hand for how I was coping in my life. And so I was there for multiple things and learning as much as I could, right?
Right. So they pretty much
They put me in
everything. Okay.
They were like, let's put her in all of the different things.
And was that kind of an eye-opening moment for you too? Like, is that the first time you kind of, you know, accepted that you had these, you know, concurrent issues going on? Or was this it was always kind of there under
the eating one was hard for me to, like, I knew that that was a problem. Alcohol, you know, was so socially acceptable that it was like, well, it may be a problem, it may not be a problem, but the way I used food and how I tied my weight to my worth and the value of my life based on how I looked, like all of those things, I knew that those were issues. And so I didn't want people to talk about them.
I see. They were right. Yeah.
And so when it came to light, then it was my relationship with how I worked in the world with men, how I worked in the world with women. And so those were things that I knew were problems, but I just was like, this is too much. I can't do it all. Like, let's just deal with alcohol. Right.
Yeah, let's just tackle this one.
And they're like, no, we're going to do a little bit of everything because you can't just fix one thing.
It's all intertwined.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So, I mean, that sounds like a, you know, really profound experience, challenging, but profound. What was the transition like coming out? You know, so many times people struggle getting out of treatment because you're in this bubble and you spend all this time on you, and then you come back and, you know, the world is still there.
Yeah,
and the challenges are still there.
It's exactly the same.
What was your experience like with that?
Well, I came out of treatment on a Friday, and I remember my son and what he was wearing, and they were waiting for me outside the gate, and just like the hug that he gave me, like that moment I hold just as tenderly as my rock bottom, because they go hand in hand, right? I spent the weekend with my family. I went to a meeting on Monday, and I still have no idea why, but I drove straight to the liquor store and I relapsed. Mm. Three days after, you know, I'd spent so much time away from my family and just wanted to get back to them so badly. Right. And, you know, I look back and I just wasn't quite done.
Right. Right. And that's so common. And there's, you know, and that's why I always, you know, I always try to pump that this is not a success and failure thing, right? Because there's a sense of guilt kind of attached to that. And I see people struggle because that is a very common thing after treatment is relapse. And, you know, especially family members don't get it. And there's that disappointment there.
Oh my gosh, disappointment and the shame in yourself. And
oh, was this all just for nothing? Mm-hmm. It's not. It's still building in your recovery. But that's a really hard one. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you face that?
Well, I thought I could get away with it, right?
Okay, right.
And so I think it was worse because I knew what my family had done to get me there, what had to happen for me to have a bed there, you know, the time away from my son. So the shame that was mounting on top of the shame I already felt, it was too much. And so obviously my son's dad caught on and they called the treatment center to see if they would take me back. And because I had just relapsed so quickly from being there, they said, no, like she will feel too much shame being around her peers that were here while she was here the first time.
Big farewell.
And then here she is back here. And it's like, as an A student growing up, it's like, well, you can't fail. Yeah. Right. And that was a failure to me. So they didn't really know what to do. I relapsed for 15 days. And then my son's dad said, you know, I'm taking your son away again. And, like, you need help. This can't be our life. Right. Mm-hmm. And so now I have a head full of some knowledge and I still don't know what to do. And, we ended up going back to Pegasus. I love Pegasus. I think that's Pegasus is
the addictions counseling here in Victoria, actually, just across the way from us.
And the same woman looked at me and she said, I just don't think you can do it, you know, but you can come here, on Monday and start our outpatient program, which means that I could still live at home and do, group therapy and counseling and, like cognitive learning with the center. But she said, you have to stay sober over the weekend. And, but she said that we can give you something to help. And so they introduced me to a Sober Link, which is like a portable breathalyzer that you can carry with you. Mm-hmm. And she said, if you use this Sober Link and you stay sober over the weekend, then you have a place here on Monday morning. And at that point, I was like, well, I have no fight left. Right. My addiction has no fight left.
Right.
It does not know what to do. We don't know what to do. All I want is to just be with my son, you know, and I was also like, oh, you tell me I can't do this. I can do this. Right.
Right. So the challenge.
I know. Right. Yeah. She did that on purpose.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
And that was on a Thursday and the next day was Friday the 13th. And that was my first day sober. And I've been sober ever since.
Wow.
So, yeah, like I feel like I needed that relapse because it introduced me to, I have the same counselor that I met at Pegasus. She's still my counselor and friend today.
Okay.
And she was the one that told me, like early into working with her, I was finally able to share kind of what was going on in my personal life, like in my relationship. I had been with my son's dad for 13 years now, and I knew that I couldn't have recovery and my relationship at the same time.
Right.
And so I was just at a crossroads because I had never spent my adult life without this person. Mm. And I loved this person, but they were so closely tied to my addiction and the things that we were dealing with in our relationship. And I was using alcohol to cope with. I knew those things weren't going to stop, but I had to stop with the alcohol. So she was the first person that said, Alicia, there's another way and you don't have to live this life. Mm-hmm. And no one had told me that because I had never shared what was going on for me.
Gotcha.
And And that was a profound moment for me in my recovery, was that there's another way.
Right.
And so my relapse happened for a reason. And while I was so upset with myself in the moment, I just needed a little more learning.
Sure.
And
yeah.
A little just more
know
connection.
That you're not, yeah, that right. There was obviously something else that one more piece to get put together.
Yeah.
And, yeah, one more connection. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that obviously that seems like it was a couple of profound moments in your life. You know, obviously there's still a lot of hard work that gets put into your recovery.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So where did that go? So you're doing outpatient treatment, you've got your counseling going on. What ended up working?
I think it was a mix of all of those things, okay. You know, so it was outpatient. It was my sober link because, you know, my mind was still telling me nobody will know. Right.
Okay. So you kept this sober link.
Oh,
going.
I kept it
this
for 14 months.
14 months.
Four
amazing.
Times a day.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So this is, yeah. There's yeah. no.
It
yeah,
wasn't
I
just
can't,
that weekend. No,
I can't brush this under. You've been brushing it under the rug since you're 16 and
yeah,
right, or
exactly.
since you're a teenager. And now
yeah.
all of a sudden.
Well, this
it's
thing
out
is
in the
not
going
to let me brush
it's,
it under right, the rug.
Yeah,
right. So
yeah.
I still to this day know that there were times where that sober link is the only thing that kind of kept me on the straight and narrow. Right. Like right. in the middle of the beam. But it was the sober link, it was outpatient, it was going to meetings, it was finding okay. a community, it was finding yeah. connections. Like, I had lived here for however many years and made, I think, one friend.
Right.
Right? And so I was building a life yeah. inside my recovery that right. was sustainable.
Right.
Right?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, for me, I think the greatest thing about the program is the mm-hmm. sense of community and the connections and the friendships that you're gaining from it, right?
Yeah.
And that sense of belonging
exactly.
in healthy ways.
Yeah,
you know?
Right?
Yeah,
they don't need me inebriated to laugh at
right.
my jokes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. And also that you know, I just love the amount of events, too, and to know mm-hmm. that you can still have fun and, you know, live a happy and, you know, exciting life without substances too, you
exactly.
know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
yeah. And getting sober in COVID, there was none of that.
That's
right.
Right. Huh.
And so I had no idea what recovery really looked like. And right. it's kind of been opening up as I continue in my journey. Right.
right.
So it went from very few in-person meetings, and I needed the in-person meetings because
yeah.
I needed that physical connection of face-to-face.
100%.
You know, I can feel your energy.
Yes.
I can feel who you are and, you know, how you support me,
mm-hmm.
right? Because,
yeah.
you know, it's one thing to kind of cry on the phone or over Zoom, but when you're sitting beside somebody and you can just
feel.
Yeah.
yeah.
And I think I cried every single meeting for the first year of
sure.
my recovery.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
it's like I needed that support and people to say that I'm going to be okay and that they believed in me. And,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, when I didn't believe in myself, right, I was
right.
still living in a lot of shame and, you know, pain. So it's like these people love me. There must be something good if
right.
these people...
Yeah.
Well.
yeah, no, and there's that, yeah, that, right, the support and, yeah,
mm-hmm.
fostering a belief in yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think all of those things for me were, like, I in recovery, I found a home group, I did mm-hmm. service, you do the steps, like, all mm-hmm. of that, finding a higher power, all of those things were so important for me and continue to be the backbone of my recovery.
Right.
Yeah.
So what does maintenance look like for you now that, you know, you're, you know, out of that kind of early recovery stage and you're seeing, you know, this success, what does, yeah. How does recovery look like, you know, for you now?
Well, I mean, it's beautiful. I'm so grateful for my recovery and for recovery in general, like that we have the ability to recover.
Mm-hmm.
I took my 1 year and I left my son's dad 3 days later. So it was like I
wow.
was doing big things in early recovery and he stayed supportive throughout. You know, he's
oh.
still supportive of my recovery because I'm a better mom.
Right.
I am the best mom because
right.
I am sober and
yeah.
he sees that and so he's super supportive. But what recovery looks like now is, you know, when I have my son, it's just me and my son. He comes to our home group. He's like a home group member.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, everybody loves him. And so he doesn't understand, like he's only six now, and he doesn't understand addiction, but he understands that mommy needs support, right? And
mm-hmm.
so he understands friendship, right? And so when I put it in the sense that, you know, my home group they're my friends, right? Mm-hmm. And I need them to make me feel happy sometimes, right? Like, he gets that.
Right.
And so I'm really kind of breaking that chain of not understanding and not talking about addiction, because, like,
right.
I'm already sharing with him in a way that's appropriate for a six-year-old, but also not hiding the fact that, you know, it's okay to not be okay, right?
Yeah, and everyone needs support.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's amazing.
And outside of, like, when he's with his dad, I do service work. I go into treatment centers and share a message.
Amazing.
I think that's, like, one of the most important things for me is going back to where it all started, right? I started this in a treatment center, and I like to give people hope that it can be okay, right? And it looks different for everybody,
right?
And but it's painful, and life doesn't get easy because you chose sobriety, right? Life's not like, okay.
Yeah, that's... Off into the sunset.
Yeah,
now.
Right. Yeah, no, totally. It absolutely gets harder.
Absolutely.
But it's so worthwhile. Right.
Right. Right.
Like, I missed my son's third birthday being in treatment, but missing one birthday but being present for the next however many in his life is just an incredible feeling. So.
Right, and that idea of being a rock.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
And also changing, like you say, changing the script for him. Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah, actually, you know. Bring that awareness for him and his life. I think that's amazing, right? So
we have this, or I grew up with this, don't ask, don't tell, don't talk about it.
Right.
Idea where it was like, what happened to you? What's happening around you? What's happening inside of you? You just don't share, right? Mm-hmm. And that was brought down from generations, right? It wasn't our parents' fault that that's how they taught us. It was how they were taught, right?
Yeah.
But for me, you know, what I want to do with my son is share that it's okay to not be okay. Right. Talk about it. Yeah. We'll get through it. Right.
Absolutely.
And we'll do it together. So it's not.
Right.
So it's not so shameful. It's not so.
Yeah. No. And also, you know, like I always say, you know, getting it out, that takes away the power.
Mm-hmm. Right? Absolutely.
It takes away its power when you can verbalize it and you can, you know, talk about it. Right.
It's
getting it out there. So.
It's beautiful. Like I think now that I live my life with love, and I just lead it with gratitude, because it's just, I'm so grateful that I was given the opportunity to find recovery, you know, and it's not linear, especially like recovery from process addictions and that kind of stuff that doesn't just, you abstain for the rest of your life, right? Like these are kind of daily practices, but having over 3 years of continued sobriety is just, it's beautiful. And I'm just like, I'm just so grateful. And to do stuff like this and to share about it and give people hope that, you know, it can get better. And you know, if I can do it, anybody can.
Absolutely. Well, and I mean, it's these, you know, that's, I think, why these podcasts have resonated so much is, you know, it's great to be able to share hope and to know that this recovery is possible. And so when you go to these treatment centers, you know, obviously that's a big message. What else, you know, or when you have someone come into, you know, your group for the first time, what do you say? What's your message that you really share? You know, is there, what advice do you give people?
Oh my gosh. Advice?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, it's funny. I'm going back to Cedars next week to be a speaker. And
okay.
So this is prepping me for it. Yeah. What advice would I give? I think the advice would be that, you know, you are enough and you're worthy of a life of recovery, and that you're capable. Like, we can do hard things.
Right.
And you'll surprise yourself with the things that you do in recovery. Like, I just dealt with something over Christmas that 4 years ago I dealt with something similar, and that sidelined me in my addiction. And this past Christmas, I did it absolutely sober.
Right.
And it's like, it surprises me that I can do those things when I couldn't before. I felt I needed alcohol. And so it's just that, keep going, right? Even if you fall down 8 times, just get back up that 9th time, because, you know, like, it's recovery is beautiful.
Right.
And my life is beautiful because I put in the work.
Right. Yeah. It's incredibly hard work.
Oh my gosh. Every day.
But it's so worth it.
Right. Yeah. I just couldn't imagine where I would be if I didn't. And I go to bed every night and close my eyes and know that I'm the best mom that I could be for my son, and he deserves the world. So it's like, if I'm just doing that and doing my recovery as best I can on a daily basis, then I'm living enough. A good life. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Great. Well, listen, it's funny. You told me, you said, I won't be talking for more than an hour. We've had a really good hour-long conversation.
Oh, my gosh. This is amazing. The longest I've talked for.
I love it. Well, that
is there any listeners still out there? Yeah, that's
right. No, that was really great. And I really appreciate it. I say this all the time. It takes so much courage to come on and be vulnerable and share your story, but it really does resonate. And I really feel like, your message is one that needs to be heard. So I really appreciate it. And yeah, thanks for taking the time out of your busy day in life to come and do this.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful experience. I'm just really grateful. So thank you, Blake.
Awesome. Thanks. Okay. Thank you so much to Alicia for coming onto this program. I'll say this pretty much every time. The courage that it takes to come on and share such an intimate and touching story, for me, it's really powerful. And, I'm just someone who's such a firm believer in vulnerability. I think it takes a lot of strength to be vulnerable. And, even just Alicia at the beginning being vulnerable and saying, hey, I'm really nervous about doing this. I think people underestimate the power of vulnerability. It's something that takes a lot of hard work and time to have the confidence to be vulnerable. I feel that's really where your true growth happens and your truth shows. So thank you so much. I really admire you, Alicia, for being able to come on and just be so candid and genuine and vulnerable. As for this program, we are going to continue this run right into the spring. A couple weeks time, we'll be dropping another podcast and another amazing story of recovery. We want to just highlight continuously that recovery is possible and the supports are there if you need them. There are places like Umbrella Society and wonderful people that can help you in your recovery journey anywhere you are. So please keep that hope alive. And we will see you in a couple weeks' time. And until then, I hope everyone is happy and healthy. Talk soon.